And background. So the first question is, why do we care about this process at all? And basically, one of the things that's very poorly understood is the behavior of strings in time-dependent spacetimes. So this is an example where we can get some information about what kind of stringy effects we might expect. Another motivation is that the pair production of either point particles or strings is very important in a lot of cosmological settings. For example, the generation of the perturbation spectrum in inflation is basically a pair production process. Same thing for the gravity waves. And in addition, you have other situations where you have a time-dependent background and you're looking at the production of other particles, for example, in reheating. One big motivation for the project that we did was some work by Steve Gubser and collaborators on the possible production of string relics in the early universe. And basically, their idea was that typically you find that the production rate for a massive particle of mass m is exponentially suppressed for large masses. So that exponential cutoff is controlled by the typical curvature scale that you have in your spacetime, which I've sort of schematically illustrated by H right there. So particles that are nearly massless, whose masses are smaller than the Hubble size, Hubble length, are pair-produced copiously. Particles who are much more massive than the Hubble parameter are not pair-produced significantly. of course, for strings, you expect typical masses of order Planck scale. However, on the other side, the density of states in the string model goes up exponentially with mass. This is the Hagedorn density of states. And what controls that is basically this alpha prime parameter. So the idea basically relies on the fact that even if the production rate goes down exponentially with mass, you have so many more possible states that you can produce that you might get to see some relics left over from the early universe. But one key assumption that goes into this is that the rate of pair production is given by the point particle rate for pair production. So you basically pretend that the pair production of a pair of massive strings should be the same as a pair production of a pair of massive particles. So this is something that might be worth checking. So just to review briefly how you usually do this calculation, you can consider, let's say, a scalar field minimally coupled with the mass term in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. And it's usually convenient just to do a substitution where you rename your field variable from phi to psi. The convenient thing here is that psi obeys a much simpler equation. It's basically just a Schrodinger equation. Whereas now, instead of your variable as you're accustomed to being x, now it's time. And so the influence of the curvature in your background is basically encoded in a kind of effective potential, which depends on exactly how the scale factor is evolving. So on the left, here's the effective potential that you might expect for something like an inflationary model. So I have the far past being back here, the infinite future being up here. I haven't stopped inflation or anything like that. So the universe just keeps inflating forever. And you see that basically when you're far in the past, this potential goes away, and so you basically have just the conventional traveling waves that you'd expect from solutions to the Schrodinger equation. And this corresponds to modes that are far inside the horizon. But as you approach t equals zero, the potential gets larger, and eventually you have a classical turning point. And this corresponds to basically modes crossing the horizon in the inflationary picture. And to study pair production, you impose the boundary condition that you only have right-moving waves on this side of the diagram, which corresponds to your field being in its vacuum state in the far past. Now, we're going to study a somewhat similar situation, but the idea we have in mind is more like the diagram on the right. So here we want to have just a tiny blip, let's say. And so you still have the same boundary conditions in the past. You still have these only right-moving waves, but you now have some transmission and reflection from this barrier. The advantage of this setup is that it's a little bit easier to handle perturbatively, which is eventually how we're going to study this in string theory. And so you might get an effective potential like this from a space-time that has a certain radius undergoes a brief period of expansion and then stays static after that point. So in the field theory case, there's another way you can go about this calculation. And so if you consider the case I was just talking about, where you had A of t being nearly constant, then it's convenient to redefine another variable g, which is basically your scale factor modified slightly. Now if you look at the action for this field psi, you find it's exactly the flat space action for psi plus a tiny perturbation, which depends on the dynamics of your background. Now, one way you can treat this is you can treat this by just adding this in as a new vertex in your Feynman diagrams when you're doing computations with the theory. So for example, normally for interactions, if let's say I had a phi to the fifth interaction, I'd have a Feynman vertex that looks something like this. And momentum conservation for this vertex demands that the sum of all the k's flowing into it is zero. But now this is a, now the vertex that gets added in the time-dependent case is a little bit strange because the new perturbation to the action is explicitly time-dependent. So essentially, this vertex carries a little bit of momentum with it. And so now I don't have to have the sum of momentum of the external legs being zero anymore. In particular, I can have two positive energy particles being created, provided that this factor delta has the right Fourier components. And so you can show that if you, let's say, just did the computation in this background, used this single Feynman vertex here and treated that as your amplitude for creating two particles from the vacuum, you get exactly the same result as you do with other methods. And so what we'd like to do is try to adapt this to see if there are any differences in the string pair production process. Now, one question that immediately arises is, why should we expect there to be any differences at all? So you might say that, sure, if you're looking at the production of highly energetic strings, you might expect some new effects to come into play. Basically, because of this bit of intuition that when you're dealing with wavelengths that are much longer than the string length, or energies much smaller than the Planck length, you expect that string processes are well described by some effective point particle field theory. However, if you look at it in this framework, if I want to create two strings of nearly Planck mass, even if the strings are comparatively long wavelength, even if they have very small spatial momenta, the momenta of the gravitons that I need to pull from my background in order to create these strings are of order string scale or higher. So in fact, if I'm creating massive string states, I shouldn't expect effective field theory to be a good description of this process. So now, what I'd like to be able to do is study strings exactly in an inflationary background, but unfortunately, I don't know how to do that. basically because in the field theory case, we could just pick any form of the scale factor that we wanted, and we could still get a consistent field theory out at the end of the day. But to get a consistent string theory, there are other constraints that must be satisfied, and so solving those constraints is a very difficult problem. But one thing we can do is we can try to build a time-dependent background out of some of the other exact solutions to string theory and see what kind of information we can get from this. So Gary talked a little bit about these PP waves, and we're going to use them to build a background. So earlier today, we heard about what goes on when you have a single PP wave, basically a gravitational wave, going through your space-time. And so here I have, just schematically, x and t. And this blue band here is my gravitational wave going through the space-time. Now, because there's a null killing vector in the space-time, you don't get any pair creation. You do get this other effect that Gary talked about, which is sometimes called mode excitation or particle transmutation, basically by which your string starts out in its ground state, goes through this region of curvature, and comes out in an excited state. And so here I've kind of illustrated that. Here's a string coming in, hits my gravitational wave. Sometimes it passes through. Sometimes it gets excited into different states. So this is kind of a strange stringy effect. You could have something like an electron presumably coming in, changing its mass and spin as it goes through a region of curvature. But as yet, it's not exactly what we want to study. So another thing you can do is just put two PP waves in your space-time. So here you have one coming in from one side, one coming in from the other side. Because you have two of these, you no longer have a null killing vector, and so you can expect that strings will be pair produced. So you still get this mode excitation that you got with a single wave, but in addition, you have pair creation of strings in this tiny region right here. Basically, because out here in the white regions, you don't have any interesting gravitational dynamics. In these blue regions here, you have approximate null killing vectors, but here you have no particular symmetries. So you expect to create strings by a four-point process where you pull a graviton from each of the waves, and then you create some excited strings in different states. So now you can actually do this calculation, and it's nice because you're basically doing a four-point calculation, which people understand pretty well. So the basic picture is I have my two gravitons coming in, representing these two metric perturbations with these momenta, and I'm going to create strings in certain excited states with excitation levels n plus and n minus. The whole amplitude ends up looking something like this. There's actually a lot of terms in the amplitude, but this is the leading term in the limit at which n is large. So fortunately, we can just study this term, and we know enough about the other terms in the expansion to be able to make some general statements about it. But these A's and B's are pretty familiar to people that have studied string scattering. They basically redefine the Mandelstam variables for this four-point process. So now basically, in the next few slides, I'm going to analyze this amplitude and try to see what other effects are appearing in the string case. So the first funny thing that happens is that, so I had two strings at different excitation levels in my process, which is a little bit funny because usually in field theory you expect only pair-produced identical particles, so you expect to make positrons and electrons, for example. And in the string case, it's quite easy to produce pairs at which the strings have different excitation levels. So the simplest case to look at is the case where you create two strings at the same excitation level. So this could be representing, let's say, producing identical particles. And what's strange about this case is that here, A and B, which I define up here, are both the same, not surprising. But you'll notice that there, A and B is basically an integer plus a small piece here. And there should be a little alpha prime understood in front here. Now, because we have these trigonometric factors in our amplitude, if I forget about this piece, the whole amplitude actually vanishes in the limit where the pair of created strings have no transverse momenta. So this is funny because for point particle case, I actually expect the amplitude to create a pair to be independent of the transverse momenta of the point particles. And I especially don't expect the amplitude to create a pair of point particles to vanish in the long wavelength limit. But here in the string case, we're seeing exactly that behavior coming from this factor in our amplitude. This is even a bit stranger because in addition to identical particles, there are a lot of pairs of excitation levels for which the same behavior applies. So I've written the first few ones down here. Basically, all these numbers are those for which you subtract one from each of the members of the pair, multiply them together, and if the result is a perfect square, then you expect this kind of behavior. So now the more general case is where the excitation levels are not the same. And here what's interesting is that even though in field theory you don't expect to produce non-identical pairs of particles, at least at tree level, in the string case it's the non-identical pairs of particles that produce the same spectrum as the field theory result. So here we kind of recover a little bit more what you expect from field theory. So now the reason this happens can actually be traced back to some pretty basic features of string scattering amplitudes. So, for example, if you look at, so my original amplitude had a factor that looked something like this. If you focus just on, let's say, this last factor here, this is basically the amplitude for scattering four open strings. It was basically guessed at by Veneziano, because it has the right pole structure. Basically, in the four-string scattering process, you need to have a simple pole whenever you have an on-shell intermediate state in your scattering. So in the case of the closed string, you have more degrees of freedom. In addition, you have left movers and right movers on the world sheet. So basically, you expect your amplitude for the closed string to be something like a product of two open string amplitudes. The problem is, is that now if you have a pole in this and a pole in this, you can have a double pole, which you're not allowed to have. And so basically to correct for that, you add an additional factor here. Now this whole expression has a double pole whenever A and B correspond to on-shell intermediate states in the T and U channel. What's happening for us is that A and B are actually the negative of on-shell values in the T and U channels. And so we have zeros in these trigonometric factors that were originally designed to cancel the double pole coming from here, but now there's no pole, and so the whole amplitude vanishes. So even though we looked at a very specific string states that we were creating, there's reasons to expect that the kind of conclusions that we find should hold for more general excited states. So another unique feature of the pair production process in this background is basically if you look at how the amplitude scales with the mass of the pair of strings that you're creating. So in field theory, as I said earlier, you expect the amplitude to create a pair of particles to fall off exponentially with mass. And the fall off is controlled by the typical curvature scale that you have in your background. In the context that we're looking at, the origin of this factor, it comes from the fact that if you create a pair of particles of given mass, you basically need to have gravitons coming into this vertex who are carrying the same momenta as the particles that you've created. And so basically, when you create a pair of particles of mass m, you're probing Fourier modes of your background geometry of momentum 2m, roughly. And you expect those to fall off exponentially, typically. So in strings, if you remember in the amplitude, you still had the same factors of the metric perturbations coming in. But now there's an additional suppression, which is basically coming from this beta function term in the amplitude. If you look at the behavior of this term for large masses, you find that this term falls off exponentially as well, but not with mass, instead with mass squared. So instead of the fall off e to the minus m that you expect from field theory, you get a much softer behavior from the pair production of strings. Now this also, you can tie back to some pretty basic features of string scattering. So for example, one of the limits in which you can analyze the four-point string process is the so-called hard scattering limit. Basically, this corresponds to scattering two particles, keeping the scattering angle fixed, but cranking up the energy. And so in this regime, you expect the amplitude to fall off like e to the minus, where this is the Mandelstam variable, basically m squared times an angular factor. And so that's exactly the behavior that we're seeing here. So tying this back to the pair production, tying this back to one of the original motivations for the project, if we ask the question, how many string relics should we be expecting from the early universe? We have the rate of production from, let's say, field theory going down like this factor, which we also have in the string case. We have the density of states going up exponentially because we're dealing with strings. We have this additional suppression, which is going down like m squared. And so this suppression is going to beat both of these other factors, especially when masses get large. So you can basically conclude that because the pair production of strings is much softer than the pair production of point particles, we expect there to be far fewer stringy relics left over from the early universe than we would normally expect. So basically, in wrapping it up, we weren't looking at a strongly curved cosmological background, but in one case where we could actually carry out an explicit calculation, it appears that the spectrum of string pairs produced differs from the field theory expectations, even in the long wavelength limit, which is a little bit surprising. Secondly, the overall rate of string pair production is much softer. So as one application, you expect fewer stringy relics than you might otherwise have expected. So if you extrapolate this to cosmological spacetimes, it suggests that there might be some uniquely string-like effects in pair production in the early universe. And so hopefully you might be able to find signatures of string theory from cosmological observations.
So when you scatter two plane gravitational waves, the space-time to the future of the collision is quite complicated, and we don't know the solution in string theory. So is your calculation essentially looking at the four-point, I mean, treating the gravitational waves perturbatively and looking at the four-point string amplitude in the regime where you're looking to create two very massive strings and sending in two gravitons? Is that basically what you did, or did you do a different... I'm wondering how you sort of...
How did we deal with the
How did you deal with the fact you don't know what the space-time is?
So, let me just go up to the board. So I know one case where the solution is known. So I guess Penrose, a long time ago, looked at two shock waves colliding and found something that looked like this. So here you have a wave profile that's something like delta of u, and then you find you get a big singularity pretty soon. So in our case, what we looked at, so we have two wave pulses that are not necessarily of shock wave form. For example, they might be e to the minus u squared over l squared in profile. And one thing that we did, because we were a little bit worried about this issue, is we we took this linearized solution where you just add two gravitational wave solutions, and we embedded it in a nonlinear exact solution of Einstein's equations, in this case an Einstein-Rosen wave. And what we found was that to second order, which is the order that we're calculating everything, you couldn't see the breakdown of perturbation theory or the formation of a singularity. If you carry it on to the next order, then there's an apparent breakdown of perturbation theory, but it turns out to be a coordinate artifact. And at fourth order, you could begin to see perturbation theory breaking down. So I think we expect that this space-time will be singular in the future, but you can basically control where that singularity occurs. So for example, by lowering the amplitude of these waves, you can push the singularity off as far in the future as you like. So, you know, singularities are basically inevitably going to develop, but here it's sort of under control. It happens at a perturbative stage that's beyond what we're looking at.
So you computed the string creation and looked at the strings at late time in some background which was like quadratically perturbed or something like that. Is that?
Well, so what do you mean by quadratically perturbed?
Well, you said that you, if you tried to do the exact calculation, you would find singularities there, which you don't know how to deal with. So you're treating the waves not just as linear waves, but as you said, you're including some sort of quadratic back reaction, but not.
Right. So we're not. So it's not really from the. We're not considering what happens at late times in this case. Basically, the pair production is a second order effect in H, whereas the breakdown of perturbation theory, which is presumably leading to the formation of a singularity, starts happening at fourth order.
Thank you.
Well, this is the, I have really the same question as Gary, but there was a point I didn't understand. Is what you actually do is not the scattering of two graviton string states in a fixed background to two massive string states. Presumably it's not that.
It's actually a little bit simpler. So we're saying that what we really want to do is something like this process in some non-trivial background. What we're saying is that we can compute this by considering this process in a flat.
So good. Okay, so that is what you did.
That's right.
That is what you did. Okay, and then there's an argument that that should be an approximation to the first thing in a weakly perturbed background, which is two colliding plane waves.
That's right. Yeah, basically, we're using this four-point process as an approximation to studying an exact string solution in this background. And because we understand how, well, because it's easy to consider how strings behave when you have weak gravitational waves around, we're basically treating it like this four-point amplitude.
Okay, so let's thank Daniel again. So we move to the last talk of this morning. Alex Vilenkin. And so the title is, yes, Anthropic Prediction for Lambda. And we feel that's
10 minutes.